Let me begin my discussion of the Purgatorio by talking about Dante's problem with when he came to write the Purgatorio. It is pretty much assumed that Dante wrote these works in order. We have commentary from some friends, we have some sense of what he was doing, and it is one of those works, and this doesn't often happen with literary figures, and particularly with very long works, but it seems to have been written from beginning to end. That is, he began at the beginning of the Inferno and worked his way through until shortly before his death, he finished the Paradiso. So he was writing the work in order, and it is interesting, it makes a kind of sense, because part of what's happening in the work, as I said last time, is Dante placing himself in the work. He is the principal character, and he is undergoing a spiritual journey. So it makes sense that the work then would be written by Dante the poet from beginning to end, showing the journey of Dante the pilgrim, who begins lost in the woods, and as we left him last week, this is sort of like a serial, when we left our hero last week, he had descended through the pits of hell and survived and made it out, and had, as the last line, which I didn't comment on last week, and I mention it now because, and we came out to see once more the stars emerging from the Inferno. It's of interest because each of the three parts of the work ends with the word stars. Okay? You'll notice it's the last word in the Inferno, it's the last word in the Purgatorio, and it's the last word that ends the complete work. So that, in a sense, what we are doing constantly as we come to the end of each part is continuing to look upward. It's that sense of always upward motion. Even when we hit the very top of Paradiso, the image is still of the stars, that the glorious heavens above. So he has gone through that, he has made it out of the Inferno. Now, in writing the Inferno, I mentioned how he had two things to go on. One, there was a kind of theological tradition, and he uses it a good bit of the time. There were ideas that had been handed down over time as to what the nature of hell was like. It was a place of great suffering. It was, if you will, the lake of fire. It is the place where those damned souls are separated from God's love. There were certain pictures, if you will. There were certain images of hell that had been handed down that were a part of tradition. He populated that with the damned souls. I mentioned how he had the ability to use the classical realm of literature to further populate it, and we get the figure of Minos, we get the centaurs, we get all of those other creatures from the classical world who are also part of the Inferno. But when he comes to the Purgatorio, he has a literary problem. And the problem facing him as an artist is that purgatory was a long-established idea within the history of the church. But there was not the same kind of imagery that had been passed on as to what purgatory was like. Obviously, again, we had the suffering souls suffering in a different way, but we didn't necessarily, you don't have all those images accumulated of the pit of hell, of the devils. There wasn't that literary framework. There were not those images. So that while at times the Inferno may seem like an extraordinary act of the imagination, and it is, the Purgatorio is a step upward even in terms of imagining, because Dante had to create the place. The pilgrim was about to embark on a journey to a real place, and he had to make purgatory real. It could not just be a theological abstraction. It had to become a real place that Dante the Pilgrim with Virgil could visit. And because there were very few rich precedents there, because purgatory was a necessary place in theology and had been viewed as such, it had rarely been, but it remained a necessary place and not a pictured place, not a defined place. So, what does he do? Well, for starters, he comes up with a brilliant idea, which is there is a sense in which purgatory repeats but reverses hell. If hell is basically a hollow cone of 9 concentric circles, That is where it's an inverted, if you will, cone. It is a great pit in the earth that Dante has circled down. What we have now is the image of the opposite, which is a mountain. Okay? The Inferno in inverted cone, Purgatory is pictured as a mountain. Hell, in a way, has been an inverted city. There are constant city references throughout the Inferno. And we also have moments when hell itself looks like a mock fortified city. You'll remember when we hit the city of Dis with the Furies on the walls, and Virgil seems helpless to go any further, and an angel has to come and open the doors of the city of Dis to allow them to pass on. It is the sense of a city, it is a fortified city, but it's a city going downward. And the only power, it is not a real city because it is not an organized place. It is not a place of souls living together in harmony, working for each other's good. It is a place of noise, stink, and hellish suffering. But the Purgatory becomes a genuine fortified city. If hell is a mock city, then Purgatory is a genuine fortified city. So the first image is of a mountain. The second image is of a city. And indeed, the moment comes, it's impermeable. It's not an easy city to get into. And I'll talk about the structure of the place in just a moment, but what happens, what we get is that the moment comes when Virgil and Dante actually enter Purgatory and begin the ascent of the mountain. And as they do so, there is an angel guarding the door to Purgatory. They have to climb up those three steps, one white, one black, and one red, and then go through a doorway. The angel has to permit them through, and then they can begin their climb of the mountain. And the vision is, no one gets through that is not permitted through by the angel. And there are all those souls in what's called the ante-purgatory, the waiting room for purgatory, before we even get to the city. There's no way they're getting in until their time has come and they're permitted through. This is a real fortified city, in the medieval sense of the word. It is like one of those Italian hill towns, if you will. And because it's a city on a hill, except here the entryway is at the bottom again, nobody gets up that mountain unless permitted to enter, unless the guardians of the city let that soul in. Some of you may have visited Italy. My favorite of them is a little town called San Gimignano, sometimes called the Manhattan of Italy. There are these wonderful towers. From the distance, they look like skyscrapers. But the towers were built at the top of this hill to make sure they could see for a long ways any soul that was attempting to come. And the city was virtually impregnable. You did not get into that city. They could spot you from miles away. And you couldn't even begin to go up the hill that leads up to San Gimignano at the top of the hill because there were lookouts. That city was fortified. Not just fortified, but there was a vision. You couldn't get in. Dante is using that. That was from his own time. That was from the world he lived in. And he applies it, if you will, to Purgatory. Purgatory is also remote. We have had glimpses of it twice so far in the work. It is fair to say that when in the Canto 1 of the Inferno, Dante finds himself lost in the dark wood, he is next to a mountain. He somehow seems to have gotten a glimpse of Purgatory, but he is incapable of climbing the mountain. He cannot go up it. It's there. His soul is not yet prepared. In order to go up, he must go down. He must first make the descent. He must first view sin, and then he can come back and be prepared to climb the mountain. But we get another glimpse of the mountain when we're in the Inferno. Ulysses, who is going about in the flame with Diomed, tells that when he broke the barriers, it's one of the great cantos, we didn't look at it, Ulysses, who sailed to the ends of the earth and then went past the boundaries set by God for human knowledge, broke past that, caught a glimpse of this mountain far away in the sea. Having broken the boundaries set by God, having passed beyond the limits, he got a glimpse of that which he was not supposed to see. And he got a glimpse of Purgatory. which seems to be set off in the sea somewhere. It is an it is a mountain. It is also an island. It is far off. It is far away. Now, Dante adds a couple of details. This island with the mountain is supposed to be in the southern hemisphere. He will make the claim in the Purgatorio that it is at the exact opposite position on the globe from Jerusalem. So that if you go to Jerusalem and were to dig straight down, eventually you would come to Mount Purgatory. So it sits on the opposite end of the earth from Jerusalem. He claims the mountain was created when Satan fell. The pit of hell was created by Satan's fall. He fell from heaven. As he hit, finally, hell was created as this mammoth angel went into the earth, displacing, if you will, all the ground around him, and the nine pits, the nine concentric circles of hell were formed until he finally came to rest at the bottom and hasn't moved since. Again, that image of motionlessness with Satan trapped in the ice at the bottom. Now, what happened to all that earth that was displaced? That earth then rose up and formed Mount Purgatory. So that all of that earth that created the mountain is the displaced earth that results from Satan's fall. It's wonderfully imaginative. It may not be as exciting as the river of blood in one sense, but this is wonderfully imaginative. What you have is the poetic imagination at work, giving us a vision of the unity even of these places. They are connected. So that we have the conical mountain then, just as we have the inverted cone. And Mount Purgatory extends beyond the realm of human nature, okay? It seems to be a mountain located on an island in an actual place in the southern hemisphere. But once we climb that mountain, and of course what we're getting is a physical representation of a spiritual state. Once we climb that mountain, we actually discover at the top of the mountain the earthly paradise. The earthly paradise still exists. Adam and Eve may have been cast out, and those angels put out to guard so that they could not get back in, but the place itself was not destroyed. The place still exists. And the human soul, Dante the Pilgrim, who by making the climb up Mount Purgatory will purge his soul of all of those sins that beset humanity, and finally arrive at that state of perfect grace that is necessary before he can make the trip through the Paradiso, comes to the point of the earthly paradise, and when he lands there, he gets a glimpse of the garden, and we get a description of that garden and what that garden looked like. Not surprisingly for Dante the Italian, the glimpse of the earthly paradise is very like a little section of Italy. It was, when he gives the description, it resembles very much a pine forest that existed north of Ravenna, where Dante finally came to rest. He spent his last years in Ravenna, and he is buried in Ravenna. His corpse lies in Ravenna. And it was thought to be one of the most beautiful places on earth. It existed, Dante knew it. It existed after the writing of the Purgatorio, so that those that wanted to go and visit Dante's vision of the earthly paradise could go to this pine forest north of Ravenna and see it. It existed until the Second World War, when American bombers took it out during the war. It no longer exists. It is barren land now. As part of World War II, Dante's earthly paradise was destroyed by American bombers. We can no longer visit the site. It's gone. But the description of it remains in the Purgatorio when he comes to give the description. So that at the top of the mountain is Eden. And it is indeed when he gets to the earthly paradise that he will change guides. Virgil will leave him and we will meet with Beatrice. Now, One other reason for the mountain. Why do we get the image of the mountain? It makes sense. In the once again, it's wonderful being here teaching this material. This morning at Prime, Psalm 23. Come, let us climb the mountain of the Lord. There it was this morning as I'm getting ready to teach the Purgatorio. You begin to understand how such great literature could again come out of the those who had been raised in the Catholic faith. Knowing scriptures, knowing the traditions, just this richness of possibilities that the literary mind could then transform. So Purgatorio is a mountain. Dante climbs it. However, again, there's a reason for the mountain. In order to climb that mountain, it is necessary to fight the force of gravity that is pulling one downward. That's just a physical fact. If you're going to climb a mountain, it's an effort because there's a countervailing force as you're trying to go up that's trying to get you down, okay? We call it gravity. We understand it better now. Everyone who's ever lived understood it. You go up to a certain point. If you're not careful, you're going to be brought back down. The image I used last week of slipping on the banana peel and discovering that you are subject to the force of gravity, which is the stuff of comedy. Well, here we have a divine comedy. And the soul is seeking to go upward. And what is the equivalent in the spiritual state of the force of gravity to pull one down? It is, of course, sin. So that as one is struggling up the mountain, as one is trying to make one's way first to the earthly paradise and then to become worthy to enter paradise, one has to be freed from sin. One has to get to the top of the mountain, overcome that gravity, the gravity of human sin and error that pulls one back down, that seeks to pull one back down, as opposed to, but this is the beauty of Mount Purgatory, there is a countervailing attraction, and that is God's love. God's love that is a countervailing force that is helping to pull one up the mountain. Unlike the mountain climber that has to climb physically through his own efforts, on Mount Purgatory, there is a countervailing force to oppose human sin, and that is the love of God, which is an attraction pulling one upward. Now, there's a moment early on when the mountain is being described to the pilgrim and Virgil, and they're about to ascend the mountain, and they're told, well, you're very fortunate. You are about to climb a mountain unlike any other mountain in the world. And what makes this mountain peculiar is the most difficult climb is at the bottom. And once we begin to approach the peak of the mountain, the climbing gets much easier. Until finally, as we approach the top, the summit, which is the real problem for a mountain climber, not on Mount Purgatory, because then, having freed ourselves from sin, being much closer to God, now God, the attraction of God's love helps just pull one upward. So in this curious way, we have an opposite experience. At the bottom of the mountain, it's a real fight, it's a real struggle because the sin is still pulling, the gravity of sin is still pulling us down. It's a wonderful depiction. It's a glorious idea. And Dante will use it. Indeed, as you see, the higher up they get, as Dante is freed from his sins, the easier the climb. It's a wonderful vision. It's a wonderful vision. Now, a couple of other things I would like to look at. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Again, I'm going to try to get through the Purgatorio in a couple of hours lecture, and you can ask questions this afternoon, but we're being brutally unfair. It's the stuff for a lifetime of study. Just be aware of that. So, but I'm just trying to give you some structure and some guidelines here. The very beginning, turn to the very beginning of the Purgatorio, and let's look where we start out. We get the vision of transition in beautiful lines, beautiful lines. The opening of Canto 1. For better waters now, the little bark of my poetic powers hoists its sails and leaves behind that cruelest of the seas. And I shall sing about that second realm where man's soul goes to purify itself and become worthy to ascend to heaven. Here let death's poetry arise to life. And he calls upon the muses. Notice in just those opening lines, we get something that is quite interesting because As we descended into hell, that pit where souls rained down, where they found themselves sinking lower and lower, we had quite the opposite thing that we're going to find on Mount Purgatory. It was only in the upper circles of the inferno that there was a great deal of motion. The souls of the lustful who flew like birds. Those souls in the river of blood that were sort of bubbled along as the stream moved. But as we sank lower and lower into the pit of hell, there was less and less motion. Until finally, when we hit the very center of the pit of hell and saw Satan, as I mentioned, we only had the mechanical motion of repeated, the wings going up and down, the ground grinding of the three jaws on the three faces of Satan. Very mechanical, but basically no motion. As we begin purgatory, we have motion. We have the image of the little bark that hoists its sails and begins moving across the waters. We have the ascent to heaven. We have movement upward. And death's poetry arises to life. And it's helping to define for us what the Purgatorio will be about. It is a place of motion and movement. It is a place of motion and movement. And the pilgrim, unlike the opening of the Inferno, who is unsure, uncertain, lost in the dark woods, now knows exactly what his verse must do. The poetry must ascend to life. It is interesting, as we begin the movement upward, as we come into the Purgatorio, art itself is going to become more important. There are certain things that define the Purgatorio. One is the notion of movement. Movement. These souls are in motion, as opposed to the souls in hell that are frozen. They have been crippled. Their lack of love, their separation from love, the distance between the damned soul and the animating force of the universe has left them paralyzed. They have become paralyzed and they cannot move. They have lost motion. But the souls of those in the Purgatorio who are ascending are constantly moving. But please notice, there is one peculiarity. Those souls may only climb Mount Purgatory when the sun shines. And as soon as the sun sets and night comes on the mountain, they are paralyzed. And at that point, under cover of darkness, they may descend the mountain. They have the ability to go back down, but minus the sun, they cannot climb any higher. They have to wait until the sun arises again the next morning. They have to wait until, if you will, that vision of the sun, the animating force, the light of God that allows them to be pulled upward reappears, and then they can move upward again. We have constant movement. We have motion. We have all the souls in purgatory as pilgrims. Dante the pilgrim joins countless other pilgrim souls, all of whom are climbing. But they have to climb in the sunlight. In darkness, they can only descend again and then have to repeat the movement upward. But before we even get to purgatory, let me give you the basic design, if you will. Many of you have it in your book, but just quickly. Purgatory itself is divided into three parts. It's in threes again. As I said, everything in the poem is in threes. And first we come to the anti-purgatory. We first come, if you will, to the waiting room, the little waiting room. And there are many souls there. And they are souls that are going to begin. One day they will begin their climb, but they have not come to the point that they may do that yet. Okay? And even there is a division in the anti-purgatory. The first ones we meet are the excommunicated. But they have to wait out, okay, I think it's 30 times the length of their life before they can begin climbing. Because they died without the sanction of the church. So they have a long time to wait. Beyond that, we come to those who were the late repentants. Those who waited till the last minute to repent. They're divided into three categories. The unshriven, the indolent, those who are just lazy, and the negligent, those who neglected in their lifetime. And then finally we come, the separation from the anti-purgatory. There is the edge of the cliff, the door. We go through the doorway and we can begin ascending the mountain. And there we have seven concentric terraces, which represent the seven deadly sins. So as we climb from terrace to terrace on the mountain and go up the mountain, on each of those terraces, one of the seven deadly sins has to be taken care of. And we have the image, you'll remember, that Dante, as he begins his climb, an angel comes and puts seven P's on his forehead, standing, of course, for peccato, the seven deadly sins. And each time he gets through one of the terraces and has made the climb, suddenly one of the P's will vanish from his forehead. We will hear the sound of a voice echoing one of the Beatitudes. And then we go up again, okay? So that it's of the vision, think of it almost as if sin, if the human soul is a masterpiece created by God, a beautiful masterpiece created by God, time in the world, human error, and sin have covered that masterpiece with layers of grime and filth. And on each one of the terraces, the painting gets cleaned up. One layer of filth and grime is taken off the painting. And one P is removed from the forehead. And as one of those levels, use the image of them going into the Sistine Chapel, which they did recently, and spent years cleaning, the tallow from the candles and the dirt from, you know, shoes of visitors. And over time, those paintings had become covered with soil, and they went in there and step by step, layer by layer, removed the dirt and grime that covered up the great masterpiece until now we can see it again, cleaned up with the beauty of the original colors. That's the vision of the human soul. And what is happening during the climb of Mount Purgatory is layer by layer of filth and grime is taken off until finally at the top, the soul shines with the beauty that it was meant to possess, and that it possessed at the moment of its baptism. That's the image we have. And as each layer goes off, we hear a beatitude. There is great joy. And the beatitude, of course, balances that particular sin. Please notice, Dante has saved the seven deadly sins for purgatory. He designed the inferno in a different way. All of those sins were there, but they were rearranged in a very different order, so we got the concentric circles of hell. But here we finally get the seven deadly sins. And then finally, we go through the wall of fire, having survived the climb, and we come to the earthly paradise. We are finally given the glimpse of Eden. So, the anti-purgatory, and then the cliff that separates purgatory, the seven terraces, the wall of fire, and Eden. What do we get? It's really arranged in nine parts. 1, 7, 1. In the same way, we have the nine concentric circles of hell. And again, we will find a similar design. I'll talk about it next week in the Paradiso. 9, of course, being a multiple of 3. It's just part of the enormous design of the entire work. Now, but I want to take one moment. I'm going to look at each of these to a degree. Here's my game plan. I want to look at one moment in the anti-purgatory and talk about the way it's designed, help give us some sense of how to read it. Then I'm going to go to essentially the middle of the climb up Mount Purgatory. I'm going to look at cantos 16, 17, and 18, which are not just the center of the climb in the purgatorio, but the center of the whole Divine Comedy. Okay, if we take them, the Divine Comedy is an enormous work. The center of that work is the center of the Purgatorio. And there we get the great discussion of the nature of love, which is central to the whole work. And we'll take a moment to look at that. And then finally, time willing, if I don't rattle on too much, what I want to do is look at the meeting with Beatrice in the earthly paradise, where the guide is shifted. Virgil disappears, Beatrice appears. I must save some time for her since this is the feast day of Saint Beatrice. It's wonderful all these things work. What better time to talk about the pilgrim Dante meeting Beatrice in the earthly paradise? So my intention is to cover all of that. Good luck to me. Here we go. I want to focus on Canto 5, particularly the end of Canto 5 of the Purgatorial, for a couple of reasons. One of them personal, two of my favorite souls are there. But also it can give us a guide as to how to read the entire work. Now, I'm in Canto 5. I'm looking particularly, I'm at line 85. These are the souls of the indolent, those who waited till the last moment to repent, okay? Those lazy souls. We have met one already who speaks, and then this begins, another soul said, "Oh, may the desire that draws you up the mountain be fulfilled, and you please help me satisfy my own. I am Buonconte, once from Montefeltro. No one, not even Giovanna, cares for me, and so I walk ashamed among these souls. I said, what violence, or was it chance, swept you so far away from Campaldim that no one ever found your burial place?" Dante knows this soul. Dante knows this man and says, "What happened to you? We never found your body. We never found where you were buried. Give me this information." He said, we get the soul replies, "Below the Casentino flows the river Archiano, which arises above the convent in the Apennines. Beyond it takes another name, and there I made my way, my throat an open wound, fleeing on foot and bloodying the plain." We get Buonconte, who was in a battle, had his throat cut, and is stumbling away from the battle as he slowly bleeds to death with his life's blood flowing from his throat. "There I went blind. I could no longer speak. But as I died, I murmured Mary's name. And there I fell and left my empty flesh. Beyond speech, moment of death, losing consciousness, having lost sight, stumbling forward, and in the last instant, he calls on the name of the Blessed Mother. I murmured Mary's name, and there I fell and left my empty flesh. Now hear the truth. Tell it to living men. God's angel took me up." It's just extraordinary stuff. He utters the name of Mary, his body falls, the next thing that happens, an angel from God descends and starts taking the soul. "And hell's fiend cried, 'Oh, you from heaven, why steal what is mine?'" The demon from hell is furious. They had this guy, and the demon is there ready to get him at the moment of death. "Why steal what is mine?" And then the demon settles. "You may be getting his immortal part, and won it for a measly tear at that." And apparently, now, we get this from the demon. Montefeltro himself doesn't say this. But as he uttered Mary's name, one tear fell. Sign of sorrow and repentance. The demon's furious. Okay. You won him. You won him for a measly tear. But for his body, I have other plans. The demon can't attack the soul. The demon goes for the body. Now the soul speaks again. "You know how vapor gathers in the air, then turns to water. When it has returned to where the cold condenses, it is rain. To that ill will, intent on evilness, he joined intelligence, and by that power within his nature stirred up mist and wind, until the valley, by the end of day, from Prato Magno to the mountain chain, was fog-bound. With dense clouds he charged the sky. The saturated air turned into rain. Water poured down, and what the sodden ground rejected filled and overflowed the deepest gullies, whose spilling waters came to join and form great torrents, rushing violently, relentlessly to reach the royal stream. Let me pause for a moment. Musa, the translator here, has done a good job there. Get the sense of the building of the waters, of the flowing, of the sense of the flooding. Close to its mouth, the raging Archiano discovered my cold body, sweeping it into the Arno, loosening the cross I'd made upon my breast in final pain. We get another detail. The detail, he named Mary, he wept a tear, and he had attempted to make in his last motion a cross to place on his breast. Loosening the cross I'd made upon my breast in final pain, it dragged me to its banks along its beds, then swathed me in the shroud of all its spoils. And the body is just swept away with the water in a flood. There were floods like that in northern Italy this summer again. They're horrifying. The water just, everything is swept along. And the demon saw to it, the demon created the storm and saw to it that the body was swept far from its home and never found again. Now, we have that battle, if you will, the battle over the individual soul. God's angel clearly wins, takes the soul to heaven, and the demon takes out its anger on the body and sees to it that the body is lost. So they never find the body. They don't know what's happened to the body. And of course, Dante at this point tells what's happened to the soul. Now, curiously, in the Inferno, we meet the father, Guido de Montefeltro. We've already seen him. And it's one of those moments where we get a parallel case. It's one of those moments when a moment in the Purgatorio reflects back to a moment in the Inferno, and we get something created that's very similar. Guido de Montefeltro shows up in the same canto as Ulysses and Diomed. He also, his soul is in a flickering flame. Dante has encountered it, and the voice speaks out of the fire to Dante. By the way, this is a little moment that Eliot uses as the epigram for the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. If I thought I were speaking to a soul who someday might return to the world, most certainly this flame would cease to flicker. But since no one, if I have heard the truth, ever returns alive from this deep pit, with no fear of dishonor, I answer you. The damned soul speaks openly to Dante because he thinks he'll never go back and report what was said. No chance. Nobody's ever gotten out of hell alive. But of course, the story is set down. We do find out the naughty secret of this damned soul. Guido de Montefeltro, I was a man, he's still speaking, I was a man of arms and then a friar. Notice again, the warrior who turns to religion late in life. We have the parallel. Except in the case of his son, we have the warrior who turns to the faith in an instant before death. Believing with the cords to make amends, and surely my belief would have come true were it not for that high priest, Pope Boniface VIII, his soul be damned. I'm quoting the damned soul. Those aren't my words. Who put me back among my early sins. I want to tell you why and how it happened. While I still had the form of bones and flesh my mother gave me, all my actions were not those of a lion, but those of a fox. The fox will appear again at the end of the Purgatorio, the image of the fox in the earthly paradise. The wiles and covert paths, I knew them all, and so employed my art that rumor of me spread to the farthest limits of the earth. He was well known for his wiliness. So I'm skipping ahead. He's called in by Pope Boniface VIII. His lofty papal seat, his sacred vows were no concern to him, nor was the cord I wore that once made those it girded leaner. There was a time when you became a friar, you did penance, you grew leaner. Now you become a friar, you expand outward. It's a magnificent image. Dante talking about the corruption of the clergy in his own day. I won't comment any further on that. I'm not a friar. As Constantine once had Silvestro brought from Mount Serapte to cure his leprosy, so this one sought me out as his physician to cure his burning fever caused by pride. He asked me to advise him. I was silent, for his words were drunken. Pope is as if drunk when he speaks of him. Then he spoke again, "Fear not, I tell you, the sin you will commit." Now, we don't get the specifics of it, but he's going to have Guido move against a particular Italian family that he wants to strike. And in fact, what he's going to do is have their home razed to the ground. The friar is becoming a warrior again, if you will. And he is going to come close to wiping out a family. "Fear not, I tell you, the sin you commit, it is forgiven. Now you will teach me how I can level Palestrina to the ground." It's awful. It's the family home. It's where the family lived. The Colonna family, they were called. Their seat was Palestrina. "Mine is the power, as you cannot deny, to lock and unlock heaven. Two keys I have, those keys my predecessor did not cherish. And when his weighty arguments had forced me to the point that silence seemed the poorer choice, I said, 'Father, since you grant me absolution for the sin I find I must fall into now, ample promise with a scant fulfillment will bring you triumph on your lofty throne.'" You know well enough, you cannot forgive a sin before it is committed. That's essentially what Boniface VIII has said. "Go do this for me. I absolve you ahead of time." The Pope should have known better. It doesn't work that way. And here we go. "Saint Francis came to get me when I died. But one of the black cherubim cried out, 'Don't touch him. Don't cheat me of what is mine. He must come down to join my other servants for the false counsel he gave. From then to now, I have been ready at his hair, because one cannot be absolved unless repentant, nor can one both repent and will a thing at once. The one is canceled by the other.' The soul then speaks, 'Oh, wretched me, how he shook when he took me, saying, perhaps you never stopped to think that I might be somewhat of a logician,' says the demon." Now, please notice the two scenes, father and son. One who became a friar, put on the face to the world of being a holy man, but did one nasty deed for the Pope, and convinced himself by false logic, it's okay, because I'm forgiven for it, but never repented of it. So the moment comes of a battle between Saint Francis, who comes for his soul, and a demon, and the demon wins. On the other hand, his son, who seemed to be a soldier, who kept away from the faith, but who in the last instant makes the cross, calls on Mary, and sheds a tear, and again a battle for the soul of the son, and this time, God's angel takes the soul to the anti-purgatory, okay? It's gotta spend a lot of time there before it can begin the climb, but it is there and it will begin the climb, and the demon is furious and therefore seizes on the body and sees to it that the body at least suffers. Those two scenes are magnificent. In order to understand them, and it's a part of Dante's design, we have these parallel moments, if you will, where a scene in one part of the work will reflect and comment on a scene in another part. This is design. And in case you think I'm making it up, let me use the end of Canto 5 to make the same point once again. Let's go back to Canto 5 of the Inferno. Canto 5 of the Inferno. Here is a case where he puts the parallel scenes in the same canto. Canto 5 of the Inferno, Canto 5 of the Purgatorio, just in case we miss it. Again, it's design. He knows what he's doing. Canto 5, which I spoke of when I talked about the Inferno, is the moment when he encountered Francesca da Rimini. It is the encounter with Francesca. I'm not going to go through the full speech, but let me put it this way. She speaks from line 88 until line 107, and then speaks again from 121 down to 138, which means Francesca talks more than almost any other soul encountered by the pilgrim anywhere. She She speaks a lot. And I said one reason that she spends so much time, we get such a vision of her, is because she is seeking to win over the pilgrim. And it works. Dante finally is so overcome with sorrow, false sorrow. He is seduced by her, if you will. We get the sense of her seductive ability, and he faints dead away. I'm going to focus on one tercet, where she talks about where she was born. This is line 97. Well, you may not have the Inferno. It's line 97. The place where I was born lies on the shore where the river Po, with its attendant streams, descends to seek its final resting place. It's one of those beautiful moments of great poetry. She talks about the place of her birth. She describes it. She takes a whole tercet to describe it. It lies on the shore of the great river, where the river and the attendant streams all descend. They fall downward before they rest. She was born at a place where things run downward and finally rest, in the same way that she who was born to beauty, her soul has run downward and sunk until it now rests in the Inferno. Look at the end of Canto 5 of the Purgatorio. Buonconte de Montefeltro has just finished speaking, and without introduction, we suddenly hear another voice. Line 130. Oh, please, when you are in the world again and are quite rested from your journey here, a third soul following on the second said, oh, please remember me. I am called Pia. Siena gave me life, Maremma death, as he knows who began it when he put his gem upon my finger, pledging faith. End of the canto. She is there with those who repented late. But notice the voice. We have another woman who speaks, another female soul who speaks to the pilgrim. In order to understand the power of this moment, we have to compare it with Francesca, who goes on at length when she talks to the pilgrim. And in fact, notice the difference in the, I'm going to go through this bit by bit. Notice the difference in the introduction. Francesca first says, O living creature, gracious and so kind, who makes your way here through this dingy air to visit us who stain the world with blood. And La Pia, as she's known, simply says, oh, please. Modesty, humility, quiet, barely willing to raise her voice, barely willing to interrupt the pilgrim on his journey. Oh, please. It's a little too, just that in and of itself. Then, I'm back to Francesca. If we could claim as friend the King of Kings, we would beseech him that he grant you peace, you who show pity for our atrocious plight. Oh, if only we were still friends with the King of Kings, we would speak to him that he would give you peace because you're pitying us. Wait a minute. We still knew God. We would appeal to God for you because you pity us. What do we end up with? Us. Us. Oh, please, when you are in the world again and are quite rested from your journey here, oh, please remember me. What's she asking for? Pray for my soul. Mine is a soul in purgatory. We again have a soul asking for remembrance, but it's very clear the reason. The reason is the souls in purgatory need the prayers of those who are living. She also has the clarity to know that this soul will go back, but she is considerate of that soul. You've had a long journey. You've had a long journey. So wait until you get back and are rested a while, and then pray for me. All the way through the Purgatorio, the souls are calling upon Dante to send word back. Tell so-and-so to pray for me. Please remember to tell, please you yourself pray for me. And this call for prayers is genuine, it is humble, and it reinforces that notion that those souls there can be helped by the prayers of the living, and thus requested. Oh, please remember me, and then very simply, I am called Pia. Okay? Finally, Siena gave me life, as opposed to the long tercet describing where Francesca comes from. Francesca da Rimini is still proud of her birthplace. She is still filled with pride. She may be in the circle of the lustful, but she is a proud, lustful soul, and goes on at length about where she was born. And then she begins rhapsodizing about the nature of love, which she has never understood. And Pia simply says, Siena gave me life, Maremma death. Here's where I was born, here's where I died. Absolute simplicity. And then a mystery. I'm not going to run through it, but remember, Francesca gives us the whole story of what happened to her. How she and Paolo met, how they encountered each other, how they began reading together, the specific book they were reading when their love began, okay? And implies how then they were murdered. We get the whole story. There's nothing lacking. Here, as he knows who began it, when he put his gem upon my finger, pledging faith. To this point, we don't know the full story. It is clear she refers to her husband, who was from Maremma, who somehow began some process when he married her and pledged faith to her, and she says no more. We can, just with that, fill out some of it. The faith was obviously broken. Her husband somehow betrayed her. Beyond that, we don't know. Nor does it matter, because she has one concern. Now the state of her soul. She does not condemn her husband. She puts no blame on him, the way that Francesca clearly seeks to put the blame on Paolo. It's other people's fault. None of that. There's no blame. There is simply the recognition that she died in Maremma, somehow connected with a marriage, her marriage. None of that matters. She now just asks for prayers. That's all we get of her. Seven lines. But the difference between the lengthy speeches of Francesca is telling, and we understand why the one soul is in purgatory and the other in the inferno for all time. Lapia will soon begin climbing the mountain, and that will be appropriate. Let me stop there. I want to get into the stages of love, but I'll save that for the 11 o'clock lecture.